excision number 16692, reel 3.
It's reel 3.
So these Spitfires attacked me, and as I sometimes say when I'm talking to people about this, I build it up a little bit by saying that everyone knows a Typhoon can't outturn a Spitfire, but in this particular case it did, because I outturned them and dived into a cloud to get away. Then I was hopelessly lost. And this is another funny thing about flying, because navigation is a funny art, really, particularly in fighters where you're pilot, gunner, navigator, the lot. You haven't got plots or anything, you try to map read. And I knew that my base was near a big lake, and I could see a big lake in the horizon, so I flew towards it. And when I got there, it wasn't the lake. And I tried to make it be the lake. It's a funny sensation. You try to make it be the lake. And so, oh dear, so I was running short of fuel, so I'd been calling up for homings, but nobody could hear me. And then I heard a Canadian Spitfire pilot says, "I can hear your bad sort of thing, and I can hear your bass. You transmit, they'll give me a course, and I'll pass it on to you." And that's how I got back. And they passed these courses on. But again, which people like to hear, we all had our own fitter and rigger on the aircraft, the airmen. Mine was a ex-Welsh miner, and one was a London lad. They were very good. They always kept like, they used to polish the aircraft on the days off. They loved the aircraft to be right. And they'd ride out on the end of the wing when you took off for an operation and sit on the grass or anything waiting for you to come back. But because I got lost in all this trouble with the Spitfires, etc., I hadn't come back. And they weren't to know that I was still airborne. And they still sat out in the end of the runway. When I flew over, eventually got back, I could see them down there. They suddenly leapt in the air, threw their hats in the air and danced about it. Very, very touching indeed. And when I landed, they both clambered on the wing and waved their hats as they flew back. It was very, you know, almost brought a tear to my eye, really, because they thought I'd had it. But that's basically the operation side. I mean, I did 26 operations in that short period, sometimes more than one a day. Sometimes with the Germans, when we've captured airfields and taken them over, the Germans will still be at the next field along. And so unlike people in other commands, we were fired at as we were taken off and landing. We were fired at by them at the close by. And of course, the same old thing always happened. We always got attacked by Mustangs of the American Air Force, because they, again, thought we were fought with 190s. We used to see them off and then carry on with our own operation, you know.
How did you see them off?
Well, it used to be a bit threatening going to a sort of a tactical turn to try to outturn them, and perhaps someone might fire an odd round at them, you know, but they would go off in the end. They weren't very persistent. Maybe they recognised who we were, I don't know, but we used to like to think we frightened them a bit. That made them think that there's something else was going to happen.
What was morale like amongst the pilots in the squadron?
But morale was very high then, although our losses were fairly heavy, not compared to the early days of the typhoons. But morale was pretty high because the whole of the British forces' morale was high, because we were advancing all the time, advancing towards Berlin, if you like to put it that way. And if it hadn't been some sort of mixes up in the high command that's allowed the Russians to get there first, we probably would have done. But that's another interesting point. We started to get into the Russian territory, Russian airspace, and we were issued not only people on the squad at the time knew about this, they were issued with a card about the size of a credit card, a little bigger, with a Union Jack on it, with words in Russian on it, which if we were shot down in Russian airspace, we had to say "Yar Anglikanin, Yar Anglikanin," and wave this card at them, because they didn't really mind if they shot Germans or RAF. Come to that, they were quite as you would expect, because they suffered so a lot, they weren't too fussy. Which is one reason why, and I hadn't told you that at the beginning, we wore khaki in the Second Tactical Air Force. Never wore Air Force blue. Because the Americans shot at anything which was bluish, and later on the Russians did. And we, from probably Normandy onwards, Second Tactical Air Force and the other ones out there all wear khaki battle dress. You had your Air Force insignias in blue and your wings, but it was particularly khaki battle dress. It was quite amazing. Just to be absolutely sure that nobody, because being mixing with all the people like Americans and then Russians and so forth, to make sure they didn't think we were Germans.
Any VE Day memories?
VE Day?
Yes. Anything particularly happened to you on VE Day?
Yes, I think we all got so drunk we don't remember 3 days afterwards. I remember very distinctly that some of the army operation liaison officers came into the mess, and we really did. I just don't remember much of that time. I know we all started having a tremendous party. I think it was about 3 days before we all came round, really. It was such a tremendous time, tremendous time. But soon afterwards, you see, we had to get together, and on May the 9th, our squadron was put into what was called 125 Wing, which was led by Johnny Johnson, the fighter ace, and we moved to Copenhagen to liberate them, if you like to say, though the army had gone in first. And that was a composite wing. Now, it's a squadron of Spitfires, us with Typhoons, and I can't remember, I think it was a squadron of Tempests as well, but there's three squadrons went in there, and of course we were absolutely besieged and by the Danes and had a wonderful time there. But the Germans were still walking about the city. They hadn't all been rounded up yet, and it's quite amazing. And we moved into some houses, which were nice semi-detached houses, which the German WAF, if you like to say, had occupied, and all the Danish ladies provided our food at the mess with nice bacon and eggs and things like that, which we hadn't had for months and months, you know. And so we had a wonderful time. I think the one thing about Copenhagen I remember more than anything else, because up till the time we were moving forward to forward airfields, and sometimes they weren't much more than a field, we had to land these very heavy Typhoons, and every time we moved we had to have a full load of rockets to cart them there, full load of petrol, our own kit stuffed in the wing, and we had to land these in little tiny bumpy fields at times. And that's probably, nobody ever think of doing it now, we didn't think anything of it, I suppose, at the time. But when we went to Copenhagen, there's this massive runway which finished in the sea, and to land on that was absolutely marvellous. You just floated on and just and this landed. It's incredible. And we stayed at Copenhagen quite a bit. And I went on leave from there, home again, the first time I'd been leave since operations. And we moved around a bit more times, but went to Husum in Germany after that, where the Germans had their Messerschmitt 262s and their Rocket 163 aircraft. And we lived in a hotel on the outside of the aerodrome. And they had these specialist aircraft there. And they had a whole lot of German WAFs who were being captured. And we used to go to our lunch in our hotel, and they used to march these WAFs by to go and get their food somewhere or something like that. And they were just as arrogant as they always were. They made rude gestures to us as they marched by, you know. Although the prisoners, always the same, they never changed. But that was in Husum, in Germany, in Jutland.
Was there any question of you going out to the Far East to fight?
Well, we didn't think we were, but as it happens, we did. We came back from Germany, my squadron 137, after the war, and it was, where should we say, 1946, probably, yes, 1946, September 1945, my squadron disbanded, and we were all given jobs in flying control, and they said no flying jobs available. So for some unknown reason, I said, what about 247 Squadron? They said, oh, yes, you can join that. That's at Chill Bolton, flying Tempest 2s under B. Beaumont, you see. So I said, well, yeah, I'll go there. As I said, it wasn't until 40 years later that I realised it was a Tiger Squadron. No wonder it was easy to get into it, because they were being trained to go out the Far East. And why they were using the Tempest 2 with the Bristol Centaurus radial engine was the fact that that could stand the heat out in the Far East, where an inline engine couldn't. Anyhow, the Japanese were all folded up, so they then, Beeman went. We still had our Tempest 2s, and then they decided to convert us onto the Vampire, first single-engine jet in the Royal Air Force. Geoffrey de Havilland came down to show us how to fly one and frighten us all to death, the display he put on. He came down, came in the mess for lunch, drank about 8 pints and went out and gave a fantastic display in this Vampire. So then we're faced with flying these things, which you sat nearly on the ground, compared with the Tempest 2 we'd flied the day before, which had a 14-foot nose in front of you and quite high up. You sat nearly on the ground, and you've got this jet engine, which is entirely different from anything with a propeller. You had to be careful when you didn't jerk the throttle or else the flame would go out and all that sort of thing. And you had to take one up. And they had a lot of top brass from the Air Ministry come down and watch us do it. And as I said in that book, supposed to do a 1,000-foot circuit, it was 4,000 feet before I realised where I was, because the wings being certain amount of swept backness, you couldn't maintain your level on the horizon like you used to with conventional aircraft. So I came into land, and having landed that morning on Tempest 2, which was that high up in the air, because I dropped the Vampire in for quite a height, and this air marshal came around and said, you made a very heavy landing there, you won't do that again, will you? I said, no sir, you know. But the point of it before I leave the Vampires was that we took part then in 3 flight paths over London. And the first Victory flight pass was done immediately after the war, with Bader leading it, and the Typhoon squadrons were in it. I wasn't on that, I was still in board. But the next year, they did a tremendous flight pass over with the Vampires being the last... the last aircraft in the line. And we did this Victory flypast over London. We did another one over the American Embassy on his birthday. And we did another one later on. We did 3 flypasts in the Vampires. And that's about all I'll say on that, because the rest were just straightforward training.